It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Congress is considering President Biden's request for $6 billion of humanitarian and defense aid for Ukraine. We'll talk to Democratic Representative Ron Kind about Russia's invasion and what he'd like to see the U.S. do next. First, loneliness is a big problem, and during the pandemic, many of us dealt with it in ways we hadn't before. A new project from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee is taking that issue on. It's called Lonely No More. It brings together researchers, experts, and artists to talk about the complexities of loneliness and strategies for getting out of lonely spells in our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When do you feel lonely? Has there been a time in your life where loneliness was a problem? Was it during the pandemic? What changed then? Or have you found a way to feel connected with friends and family, especially during the pandemic? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Anne Basting is leading the Loneliness Project. She's a professor of English and director of the Center for 21st Century Studies at UW-Milwaukee. And welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Why take on loneliness as your first project as part of this new center?
Well, I just started as the director in August, and we picked themes. My tenure is 3 years, and so we picked three themes: well, duty, and trust. And within that sort of umbrella, we picked Lonely No More, the making and unmaking of loneliness, isolation, and connectedness. And then next spring, we'll turn to nourishing trust. And also then in the third year, looking at voting.
Loneliness, I know, was a concern in the United States even before the pandemic. What are some of the reasons you think are behind that?
You know, it's really interesting. I've been, of course, doing a lot of reading and then bringing together a lot of speakers that will be having some virtual roundtable conversations. It's really in 2018, the UK had a minister, created the position of a minister of loneliness, followed by Japan that did the same thing. We in the United States had the National Academies of Science pull together a task force to do a report on social isolation and loneliness that came out on the internet in February of 2020, just so people could read it as they were on lockdown to learn how bad it is for your health. So it's been going, the interest has been surging before, but then I think with the pandemic, it was just felt. The research has really also been supporting the links between the health impacts of loneliness and isolation, the stress responses in the body, and just how profoundly loneliness can affect our health.
One thing that struck me is a survey you did on loneliness, and it wasn't just, you know, scale of 1 to 5 stuff. It was a lot of opportunities for people to kind of describe the subjective experience of how loneliness felt, some of the emotional words that surround it. And a lot of people, we'll get into this, talked about the circumstances in which they felt lonely and in which they felt connected. What were some of the things that have struck you about some of these new survey results?
You know what? You're right. We really wanted to go kind of beyond just the Likert scale of 1 to 5. We wanted to really draw in people's responses to the sensory and the narrative behind people's experiences of loneliness. So there were just 10 questions, and we called it, as part of our spring programming, a participatory research project. Just 10 questions. When you think of a moment when you experienced loneliness, what are three words that come to mind? And then we asked, similarly, what are the colors that come to mind? What are the sounds that come to mind? And then, is there a story when you think about a moment of loneliness? What story comes to mind? And then we did the same thing for connectedness. And then the final question was, what are some tactics that you've used to move from one state to the other? Really celebrating and focusing in on people's resilience. And I was really struck. We had the survey open January and February, and I was really struck by the earnestness and the thought that people put into their responses, sharing some really beautiful stories in all three of the areas. And the results were really great. We had pretty good, strong participation. And yeah, I'm happy to share a little bit about the results. They'll also be on the center's website as well.
Well, one thing that really struck me about when people describe when they felt lonely, when they felt connected, I think if I picture in my head, you say a lonely person, I'm thinking a person in a room by themselves. But so many of the examples of loneliness are in front of a classroom, with a partner in a neglectful relationship, like being lonely around people. Some of the connected examples are kind of epiphanies, wonderful experiences of solitude, but feeling a sense of connection anyway. What does that tell you about loneliness?
It really tells you that it doesn't matter whether you're in solitude or physically away from other people, that loneliness is a perceived emotion. And that it can happen when you feel misunderstood in a group of people or disconnected from a group of people, or it can happen when you're all by yourself. Either way, you know, also as part of our programming, we have little tiny short podcasts. They're called 6.5 Minutes With. And this week's podcast is with a religious studies professor at UWM, David Del Valerio, who does research into ancient practices, Tibetan practices of meditation, long-term solitary meditative practices. And he talks about how the word lonely never comes up in that in those histories. And it's because I think when isolation is attached with purpose and meaning, we don't feel it as loneliness. And that really, that theme came up over and over again. And in a lot of the research and some of the speakers we have coming in, their research really looks at the connection between the negative impacts of loneliness around when people feel a lack of purpose and meaning.
We're talking to Anne Basting from UW-Milwaukee about a new project there called Lonely No More, getting a lot of perspectives on loneliness, what it is, what drives it, and what to do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you want to answer some of those survey questions we were just talking about. What does loneliness feel like? What words do you use to describe it? What situations in your life have you felt lonely? If you've come out of a lonely part of your life, what did it take? How did you get connected to people? How did you feel connected to people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And when I've talked to you in the past about your work with people dealing with dementia, I was always impressed by kind of all the disciplines you draw from and the wide variety of perspectives. That's what you're doing here too with loneliness. Can you talk about the range of perspectives you're bringing in on this?
Sure. Well, and the survey is one of them, right? Yeah. Because today we also are sharing out the survey results and making them public. And along with that comes a call for creative contributions. And people, if they visit the website, will see that. And we're asking people to respond to the survey results and share with us writing or visual art or proposals for change making, social change around easing isolation, and submitting those to us by May 1st. And then we will share those publicly in June. We're also doing those 6.5 minute podcasts with a whole range of really fascinating people. Professor Helen Bader Endowed Professor of Applied Gerontology, Colleen Galambos in social welfare at UWM, was on that task force that I talked about, the National Academies of Science. And she shares with us in her podcast some of the findings from that report. David De Valerio from Religious Studies. One of our speakers coming up is Stephanie Gibson, who's a PhD candidate at University of Pennsylvania in art history, who writes about monuments and memorials to trauma. And she led tours at a prison in Eastern Philadelphia that was designed for all solitary confinement, and just sort of explaining to people viscerally and experientially what that means going through that experience. We've divided up the virtual roundtable conversations into addressing the infrastructures of loneliness. So what are those things that help us make experiences of loneliness or unmake them socially and physically And the first one of those roundtables has Eric Kleinenberg, who's written quite a bit about the move toward living alone in Western cultures and just how infrastructurally we aren't really set up to handle that. And so we're on the fly trying to create systems to connect people. He talks a lot in one book in particular called Palaces for the People, mm-hmm. about the power of libraries for social infrastructure. And then also in that conversation, we're bringing in Joan Johnson, who's the head of the Milwaukee Public Library System. Chikako Ozawa da Silva will be on that call. She writes about lonely societies and particularly looking at Japan and the lack of meaning and sense of purpose in young people's lives in Japan as being very overwhelming while she was researching it. And then Jason Danley, who writes about aging in Japan. So it's really kind of a cross-cultural look around two different cultures dealing with loneliness and social infrastructures to handle them.
We're talking about loneliness with Anne Basting, English professor, director of the Center for 21st Century Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She's with us today to talk about the center's new project called Lonely No More. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has loneliness shown up at different parts of your life? How has it changed maybe during the pandemic? Or I've seen some studies, talked to some people about this. Have you found new ways to connect with people? Maybe better ways, ways that felt made you feel more connected than you were before the pandemic? Love to hear about that. You could join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. By the way, you can check out a conversation with Eric Kleinenberg at the WPR archives. He joined us to talk about that book, Palaces for the People, when it came out. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about loneliness and a new project at UW-Milwaukee called Lonely No More. Anne Basting is leading that project and stays with us. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences with loneliness. Have you found ways to work through a lonely point in your life? What did it take to build, maybe rebuild connections or to find new ways of dealing with solitude that made it a positive, not a negative in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And another part of Lonely No More, I understand, is an interactive book club. What is that? How's it going to work?
Well, it's really a collection around all the different topics that we're discussing around loneliness. So the infrastructures of loneliness. We have one called Weaponizing Loneliness, where, we have this thing in this country called solitary confinement, where we know the negative impact of isolation, and yet we deliberately create it widely in our carceral system. And so we have some reformers on talking about the implications of that, and then also the resilience of people who are incarcerated to those experiences. We've got the interactive book club shares readings from all of the different conversations that we're having. So people can pop on there and look at the different conversations and then give us an email if people would like to have a discussion and host a discussion with us about it.
I should ask, there's a lot of ways for the public to participate in various elements of this. What is the best bet? What's the best way to start if people want to participate in the book club or the call for responses and poetry and things like that?
It's all right at the website, uwm.edu, and then /C21, Center for 21st Century Studies.
What are you hoping for the outcome? You've got a lot of different angles here, a lot of public participation. What is your goal? What are your hopes for the success of this project?
Well, I think in general, the way we've restructured our programming is really that the humanities are critical to human experience. I think we're an interdisciplinary humanity center since 1968. And we're really seeking to build a community of scholars to address the most pressing issues of our time. So really getting these issues out all across the state, a big believer in the Wisconsin idea, all the way to the borders of the state. And having people participate in all kinds of different ways. We've stretched out the programming so that we have multiple points of access and multiple ways of knowing as we describe it. The really fascinating thing, I think, is the call for creative contributions that the people will see on the website today. And also to check out the survey results. Our deputy director, Nicole Welk-Yeager, created this beautiful report. And you can read about the strategies for loneliness relief in that report. The responses were really illuminating. People, 22% of people said they call a friend, 16% listen to music, and 14% get out into nature and take a walk. I loved how some people shared their tactics, some of which were effective and some aren't effective. So one said, visit a coffee shop, effective, take a nap, ineffective. Another person said, bad habit, scroll social media, better coping skill, pick up the phone and actually call someone, especially my sister. So you'll get to read all these responses on there. And I think they give people sort of a sense of people's humor, but also you can feel the pain and struggling with some of these conditions, especially around the experiences of loneliness.
Talking to Ann Basting about the Lonely No More Project at UW-Milwaukee. If you're feeling shy about sharing your loneliness experience, I understand that. But if you're willing to share, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. And nobody's calling in right now, which maybe doesn't surprise me that much. Are people reluctant in some cases, do you think, to talk about their loneliness, especially in a public forum as opposed to maybe a private survey?
I mean, we got hundreds of responses to the survey that were deep and genuine. Mm-hmm. And it was completely anonymous, really only asking people for where they lived. And we had, 38% of people were from Wisconsin. But our answers were from 5 different countries and 26 different states. So we had quite a range of responses. And I do think, you know, there is a stigma around the experience of loneliness. People think it's a personal failure of some sort, but it's not. I mean, all of the reading support, all the research supports the fact that loneliness is a human condition. In fact, it's part of our baked into our genetics and our evolutionary component, because it tells you sort of throws up a caution and sets up a stress response to tell you that you need to get back connected to other human beings. That's why it raises stress levels for people. I think people associated, to me, some of the most interesting responses were in the color questions that we got. Mm-hmm. 45% of people talked about the color being gray, and 20% said blue. And yet, in contrast, when we asked about connectedness, 13% of people said blue. And really, what the responses really kind of felt like was that people associate loneliness with a lack of color and connectedness with a range of brightness. So it was pretty equal between like blue and yellow and green and red, almost as though isolation is more of a lack of color and connectedness is colorful. The sounds were really interesting as well, that 28% of respondents associated loneliness with silence. But also what I saw coming up in sort of the word cloud there was sounds of more of machinery. People talked about clicks and hums and static, as though all you could hear was machines and not other human beings. And then in the sound responses to connectivity and feeling connected, you heard sounds of nature and human beings. So water, laughter, chatter, wind, people just said nature, things like that. So it's interesting also how I think one of our roundtable discussions is on
I want to jump in, Anne. I'm sorry. Yeah. We've got a caller. Dawn is with us in New Berlin. Want to get talk to Dawn before we run out of time. Hi, Dawn.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Dawn?
So, well, I was just calling if you've had any experiences. My husband passed away 2 months before COVID, and then COVID hit, and it was kind of like a double whammy. So I just been trying to adjust and moving and a lot of life changes and just, you know, trying to figure out how to cope with all of this.
Don, that is so hard and understandable that would be hard. Have you found at least small ways to feel connected with people?
Oh, yeah. Like, I have friends, you know, just getting out with nature. Like, today I took a long walk, and that helps, but it's still, you know, so different going home to an empty house.
Of course. Of course. Dawn, thank you so much for sharing that story. Best to you. And Dawn is exactly the person you're hoping to find some good strategies for, some ways to help connect.
Yeah, and we heard stories like that too of people of the overlap between loss and grief, particularly in the pandemic when so much of that was pronounced. You know, with Dawn, it happened right before, and then the isolation of the pandemic sort of ratcheted that whole experience up. I think that the survey really, the stories inside of the moments of loneliness and connectedness are really reassuring. That people can, there are tactics between the two. It's not like the state, like you'll only move from one to the other permanently. It's more of a constant cycle where you can find ways to bring yourself into feelings of connectedness when you're feeling that being overwhelmed by loss and by missing someone. I think that a lot of people talked about the power of writing and really articulating the feelings. And I'm thankful to Dawn for saying that here, because a lot of people go through that. And to write it and say it out loud, that's what one of the respondents said. When I feel that profound loneliness, I say, oh, I am feeling this loneliness. It is normal and I am going to move through it.
That's a great place to leave it. Dawn, thanks for the call, and thanks to Anne Basting for joining us, professor of English and director of the Center for 21st Century Studies at UW-Milwaukee, talking about the Lonely No More Project. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time with a lot more info. Stick around, more coming up here on Central Time. Now, Russia's attack on Ukraine continued during the last day with increased bombing of civilian areas. There were reports of multiple civilian casualties in the second largest city of Kharkiv, and a convoy of more Russian troops was headed toward the capital city of Kyiv today. The invasion brought several rounds of economic sanctions from the United States and allies over the last week. In Congress, members of both parties have condemned Russia's attack, and lawmakers are considering President Biden's request for $6.4 billion of humanitarian and security aid for Ukraine. The Ideas Network reached out to Wisconsin's delegation to talk with them about the situation in Ukraine. On Thursday, Republican Representative Mike Gallagher joins the morning show. Ron Kind joins us now. He's a Democrat representing the 3rd Congressional District in Western Wisconsin. Representative Kind, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Glad to be with you.
What are your thoughts on the situation in Ukraine today and how the U.S. and allies have responded so far?
Well, this cannot stand. Putin cannot win, and he will not win in the long run. And I'm very pleased with the show of unity throughout the free world. In fact, last week I was in London all week long helping coordinate the economic sanctions regime at number 10 and with the Treasury and Trade Ministry. And it's remarkable the amount of unity that's come together. I give a lot of the credit to President Biden. He knows these world leaders by name. And I did not miss the fact that it was mentioned to me on a couple of occasions that it sure is nice having a president of the United States willing to lead NATO rather than trying to destroy NATO. And that's coming through right now. But listen, most of the credit goes to the incredible resilience and courage of the Ukrainian people, President Zelensky, the amount of fight that's in their belly. It's been inspiring. And so we're doing everything we can right now, from economic sanctions to military assistance, humanitarian assistance, to help the Ukrainian people who are facing their darkest hour right now.
Some of your Republican colleagues have criticized the Biden administration for not doing enough up front to deter the invasion in the first place. What would you say to them?
Well, first of all, let's stop blaming America first. Let's stop blaming President Biden first. This is one person and one person alone who's guilty, and that's Vladimir Putin. But let's also not forget recent history. It was President Trump that was blackmailing President Zelensky, withholding military assistance in order to get him to do a political hit job on Joe Biden. And it was President Trump that refused to give President Zelensky an audience in the White House. And it was President Trump that withdrew our ambassador from Ukraine because he didn't like the way she was exposing a lot of the nefarious things that were going on there. So, I mean, the previous administration was doing everything that Vladimir Putin was hoping would be done against Ukraine. So we can play the blame game all we want here, but right now it's all hands on deck. And I'm incredibly proud that the free world sees this crisis for what it is. It's a battle between free and independent and democratic nations versus tyranny. And Vladimir Putin trying to expand a sphere of influence and resurrect a Soviet empire that no longer exists.
President Biden has asked Congress to approve $6.4 billion of aid. That would include money for both humanitarian support and some security assistance. What are your thoughts on Congress passing this package or something similar to it?
I anticipate wide bipartisan support. I mean, Congress has come together and see the urgency of the moment and the need to do more to Ukraine and the fighting forces there, but also recognizing the humanitarian catastrophe that Putin has created, standing up the refugee camps now just across the border. And it's not just us. I mean, we have great support throughout NATO, throughout Europe, many other nations throughout the world are contributing. And so we've never seen a coalition of this kind come together as quickly as it has in world history. And so that too, if I were Vladimir Putin, would cause a lot of pause in me and great concern about where all this is going to end up. And I anticipate it's going to end up very badly for him. And I'm happy that the economic sanctions are already taking root and impacting Russia's economy. The ruble's in a free fall. They lost 40% in their stock market the first day. They had to suspend their stock market because of the free fall there. And their banking system is cut off from the international finance system. So in a lot of ways, I think Vladimir Putin way overestimated the situation. He thought he had a divided Ukraine, a divided Europe, a divided NATO, and a divided America to exploit. And just the opposite is occurring right now. And that's why I'm confident that he's not going to be able to succeed in what he's trying to do.
Talking to Ron Kind, Democrat representing Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, looking at Ukraine and the Russian invasion there. Congressman Kind, President Biden has ruled out U.S. troops in Ukraine. There have been calls from some Ukrainian leaders, some here in the United States, to establish some kind of no-fly zone for Russian aircraft in Ukrainian airspace. What do you think of that idea?
Well, let's be clear. A no-fly zone is World War III because it will bring us in direct military conflict with Russia. And then all bets are off when it comes to the escalation of that military conflict. So I think President Biden has been clear. NATO has been clear. And I think President Zelensky understands that that's not a viable option. Otherwise, you're going to really spark a World War III type of situation. Now, you know, Vladimir Putin was also rattling his nuclear sabers, too, a little bit. I think that was more to try to keep NATO out, that if we were to escalate our military confrontation. And listen, right now, the Russian military is completely exposed in Ukraine with long jam supply lines, with a lot of their mechanized divisions stuck right now. I'm sure our military experts are looking at the situation, licking their chops, thinking, man, we could really hit him and hit him hard. But unfortunately, Ukraine is not a NATO nation, and therefore that mutual security pledge does not exist. And there's a reason why there's a process to joining NATO, and Ukraine hadn't completed that process.
Do you worry that supplying lethal aid directly from U.S. and NATO countries to Ukraine could be read as an escalation from Putin, lead him to respond more forcefully to Western countries? He could say, hey, you're sending gear that's killing our soldiers.
I'm worried about Putin's state of mind. He's been in a bunker for 2 years because of COVID. He has shut himself off from any advisors, and he's acting irrationally throughout this whole process. So, yeah, I mean, that is being calculated, and our intelligence agencies are doing their assessments of Putin's state of mind. But we've done this before. I mean, we armed the Mujahideen when the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan. They knew it. We knew it. The world knew it. And it didn't lead to an escalation at that point. But It's not just us, though, Rob. I mean, we have a united free world. Many other nations are contributing weaponry right now, including Germany. Their longstanding policy of neutrality when it came to military conflict, they have reversed that. Even a country like Switzerland, since the Second World War, has been prideful of their neutral position in world affairs, has condemned Russia and has frozen assets, joined the economic sanctions. You know, if you get in trouble with Switzerland, you're in a lot of trouble. That's like your mom calling you by your middle name. And so that just shows you the strength of this international coalition standing up in one collective voice saying, no, Putin, you're wrong, and you will pay a heavy price.
Do you see room for more sanctions, whether targeting Russia as a whole or more efforts to target people connected with the Putin regime?
Yeah, that's one of the things I was getting into over in Britain, too, because a lot of Russian oligarchs that have invested heavily in London, real estate, for instance, exposing them. We've got a special division at Treasury that can help track this money, Putin's money, too. Listen, they're very wealthy, so they can hire some of the best lawyers in the world and shell companies and third-party transactions to try to hide this. But we're getting a lot better at being able to identify it and start really hitting Putin individually and a lot of his oligarchs that have enabled him to stay in power. But a lot more work needs to be done. Ultimately, the key here is help Europe wean themselves off from energy dependence on Russia. I mean, they're getting 40% of their natural gas, over 25% of the Russian oil for their energy needs. We're stepping up now, trying to supplant that ourselves and with other countries through LNGs. Germany, I think, has a hard assessment to make on their future energy needs. And let's face it, we're still importing a little bit of oil from Russia ourselves for Alaska and Hawaii. It's not a lot, but I think symbolically we have to cut that off if we're going to be asking other nations to cut off Russia too.
Before we wrap up, Representative Kind, on the off chance that people in Russia are listening, are able to listen online to the show, what would be your message to the Russian people?
Well, the free world has risen up against your leader, Vladimir Putin. I would also advise them, don't listen to our former president. It was outrageous that Donald Trump was making complimentary statements to Vladimir Putin at a time when he was invading Ukraine. And when I was in London, Rob, I noticed that Russian media was playing that nonstop as their major propaganda piece. It's showing support for Putin and what he was doing in Ukraine. A former president of the United States being used as Russia's chief propaganda item is outrageous, and it was embarrassing. So I'd tell the Russian people, listen and look at what the free world is doing against your leader, and not necessarily what Donald Trump has to say about any of this.
Representative Kind, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Ron Kind is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District in Western Wisconsin. He talked to us today about Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the U.S. response. President Biden made history when he nominated Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson for the U.S. Supreme Court. She's the first black woman to be selected for the nation's highest court, set to replace retiring Justice Stephen Breyer, who Jackson previously worked under. She thanked her predecessor in her speech accepting the nomination late last week.
Justice Breyer, the members of the Senate will decide if I fill your seat, but please know that I could never fill your shoes.
We're exploring Jackson's judicial record, how the confirmation process could play out. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
What stands out to you the most about Judge Jackson's experience as a lawyer and as a judge?
I think what is most interesting about her background is that she served as a federal public defender for a couple of years in Washington, D.C. That's quite unusual for members of the high court whose path to that position on the highest court in the land is usually set by education in top schools, which Judge Jackson has, but also long careers in public service. And it's usually on the prosecutorial side or in sort of these white shoe law firms, you know, these very prominent law firms. And that's how you make your connections, because you have to make political connections. But when you work with public defenders, you're on the side of the accused. And that provides a completely different lens for a justice about how you're going to decide cases, but also how you're going to engage in discussions with attorneys who are arguing before the court. And most importantly, your colleagues on the bench and how they may interpret or reinterpret these important elements of the Constitution to protect the rights of the criminally accused. So that really stands out to me as something that she's going to bring to the bench that we haven't seen in the past.
One thing I think a lot of the public and politicians wonder about is, where does a new justice fit on the ideological spectrum of the court? That's something that in a confirmation process, the would-be justice will try to say as little about as possible. Can we form any judgments based on Jackson's career and rulings in the past?
I think at this point, it's a little bit difficult, primarily because she has spent less than a year on an appellate court. When you're on an appellate court, and that would be the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, you have an opportunity to write long-form judicial opinions, and you can really see that philosophy coming through. She spent most of her time on the bench at the district court or trial court level in the federal judiciary system. And as a result, it's harder to get a sense. Also, working for Breyer, who tends to be rather moderate, one wonders if that kind of rubbed off on her in any particular way. But I think that the administration very likely did its homework. And someone like Biden, who knows the importance of these appointments, he was on the Judiciary Committee in the Senate for a very long time, probably remember him from the confirmation hearing for Justice Thomas. I can't believe that they don't know that she's matching Biden's own ideological perspectives that obviously lean liberal.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College, looking at the nominee to replace Stephen Breyer on the Supreme Court, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, and the confirmation process ahead. Charlie, these don't tend to be like hug-filled happy fests, these confirmations. What do you expect this time around?
Well, I think we're going to see some of the Senate's performative art coming through in the questioning. That's what happens here. Everybody has a stage. These are covered in the national news, and it's a great launching pad for younger senators to place themselves out in the public eye, and more senior members of the Senate. They're obviously going to want to burnish their bona fides with the public. You know, when she went up for the district court appointment, she was approved by unanimous consent. There was no objection to that appointment. And when she went up for the appointment to the D.C. Circuit Court, you know, she was opposed by 44 members. I don't think she's going to persuade many more to come to her side. But she did get a little support from Republicans. Collins and Graham and Murkowski all voted for her. Graham's already indicated a little bit of hesitation about elevating her to the high court. But I suspect because it's an election year, because she is the first, will be the first woman who's Black nominated to the court, there's going to be some punches that get pulled. Because even though we're more polarized now and we have high polarization among the parties, I think that they're going to recognize the importance of this nomination, that she is immensely qualified for this seat. And so hopefully it'll tamp down some of the worst excesses that we sometimes see in these confirmation battles.
We see some conservative officials and retired judges who are prominent in the conservative legal community actually endorsing Jackson. The National Fraternal Order of Police, I'm looking at a very supportive press release from them here in Wisconsin. Former Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, who has sort of a distant marriage to sibling kind of relationship, spoke positively of her. Does that matter? Does that help smooth the ride for her in the Senate?
It does to a certain extent, but you have to remember, as Tip O'Neill famously said, all politics is local. And so, you know, especially for members of the Senate who may be going up for re-election, who are Republicans, they want to make sure that they're reflecting to their supporters a position that would jibe with the ideology. So, I mean, certainly it helps. And maybe for some of those members who would have waded into the thicket, they'll wait it out because they see, like, if the Fraternal Order of the Police are on someone's side like this, that's a pretty strong endorsement. And if you get some individuals who have been leading voices in Republican and conservative politics for years supporting her, I think it gives you cover if you're a member of the U.S. Senate. And so that helps to provide that shield. But I still think we're going to see what we've seen since the 1980s, which is still hotly contested arguments about whether or not she deserves this particular seat.
Looking at the ideological balance of the court, even if the new justice would be on the liberal spectrum of things, there's a pretty solid conservative majority. Does a new justice make a big difference here?
I don't think she will in the near term make a big difference. I think she might persuade a bit on the merits, maybe soften some of the positions that are taken and then, you know, the way in which doctrine is shaped. But it's going to be lonely. I mean, there's going to be three liberals at the lunch table, and that's going to be it. And until we get some other openings when there's a Democratic president, it's going to be very hard to have an influence on the way doctrine is developed. But, you know, there have been some very powerful dissents written in United States history, and she can contribute to the arguments and the discussion of the law in that way. And I always describe dissents as little hand grenades where the pin hasn't been really pulled yet. And it can be used later when you have the weight of a particular perspective on your side, you pull the pin, and that dissent now becomes something that you can leverage to be a majority opinion. That's the kind of influence she can have. You don't have to wait to have five liberals on the bench to have an effect. You can do it through these means as well.
That's something I've loved to hear, Charlie. I think she's 51 and she keeps being described as young, which I appreciate. But this is also something on a more serious note. It's a lifetime appointment. You might be appointed as a minority, you know, on the minority side of the court. You might find yourself in a majority, who knows, in 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think you think back to when Clarence Thomas was appointed. Well, certainly he had some influence out of the gate. I mean, he had to wait quite a long time to have, you know, the kind of group together where his voice could have a real influence, and quite literally his voice. I mean, for years he sat mute on the bench and hardly contributed at all. And I think in part that was because of the makeup of the bench. And you start to see him come out and have a greater voice now that he can contribute in a more meaningful way. And that may happen to Judge Jackson over time. And again, it just depends on how our politics evolves. Remember, we had a very strong liberal majority on the bench from, you know, the 1930s when FDR took over until really the early 1980s when you started to see the shift with Ronald Reagan's appointment. So, it's not unusual to see the pendulum swing like this, and it will likely swing back at some point in the future.
What do we know about the timeline of the confirmation process?
Well, I think that the goal is to make sure that she's going to be confirmed so that she can install clerks that she's going to need to do the job and to be able to dive into the writs of certiorari and the briefs that are presented to the court to take new cases and to rule on the ones that will be on the docket in the fall. Remember that the first Monday of October is when their term begins, but there's a lot of preparation. So my guess is that the administration and the Democratic majority in the Senate is going to stomp pretty hard on the accelerator here. But I would expect that they're going to try to get it done before the August recess, that Washington typically goes on for the entire month of August. So my suspicion is it's not going to be quick, but it should probably be done by the middle of the summer.
And briefly, Charlie, this is unfilibusterable under changes in Senate rules under then Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. With a 50-50 Senate, are there procedural things that Republicans could do to stop this or slow it down?
Slow it down a little bit, but stop is going to be difficult unless something dramatic happens. I mean, we had a member of the Senate who suffered some medical issues recently. Those kinds of things can be disruptive. But my suspicion is that the Republicans are going to understand that they played hard with some rules in the past, but they don't have control right now. And so they're going to have to kind of sit down and take a back seat as this unfolds.
Charlie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Charlie Jacobs, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. He was with us today to talk about President Biden's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson and for a look at the ahead at the confirmation process.